just bring it right back.
This is the single largest action in modern American history, stripping any group of non-citizens of immigration status.
The Supreme Court has allowed the Trump administration to remove legal protections for roughly 350,000 Venezuelans.
For Monday, May 19th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Biden has been diagnosed with prostate cancer.
Survival rate for the disease has increased dramatically in the last few decades.
Prostate cancer mortality has fallen by about 50% since the early 90s, which is a spectacular number.
More Americans are signing up to join the military after a post-pandemic lull.
So what's behind the turnaround?
If you ask the Trump administration, they'll say it's because of who won the election.
There is no data that says, you know, did the outcome of the election spur you to join the military?
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump and Russian leader Vladimir Putin spoke about the ongoing conflict in Ukraine for about 2 hours today. NPR's Mara Liasson reports the results were modest.
After the phone call, President Trump posted that Russia and Ukraine would begin talks about a ceasefire. Ukraine has already agreed to a U.S. ceasefire plan, but Russia has not. Trump said the tone of the conversation was excellent and that Russia wants, quote, large-scale trade with the U.S. But there was no indication that the call had produced a breakthrough. After the call, Putin repeated his view that the root causes of the crisis need to be addressed, his way of saying that Ukraine would return to its former status as a satellite of Russia. Trump has shown increasing frustration with the lack of progress. Before the call, Vice President J.D. Vance repeated that the U.S. was willing to walk away from the negotiations if they made no headway. That's one of the outcomes Russia would welcome and Ukraine would not. Mara Liasson, NPR News, the White House.
The Supreme Court has ruled in favor of the Trump administration, ending temporary protected status for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans in the U.S. Protected status had been extended under President Biden. High Court granted the Justice Department's request to lift a judge's order that blocked Homeland Security Secretary Christine Noem from moving to deport Venezuelans under temporary protected status. Officials with the National Transportation Safety Board say they've determined there was no structural damage under the Brooklyn Bridge when it was struck by a Mexican sailing vessel. NPR's Greg Allen reports investigators say the ship accelerated before hitting the bridge Saturday, killing two crew members.
NTSB investigators say they haven't yet been granted access to the Mexican Navy ship or allowed to speak to the crew members, the harbor pilot, or the captain of the tugboat that was guiding the vessel before it hit the bridge. At a briefing, investigator Brian Young says the tall-masted sailing ship gained speed before the collision.
We do have a bit of time where it was maintaining a constant speed of about 2.3 knots, and then the speed began to increase.
Winds were at 11 miles per hour, and the current was pushing the ship toward the bridge. The ship was moving at 6 knots, about 7 miles per hour, when its mast struck the bridge. Greg Allen, NPR News.
The yield on Treasury bonds is rising after Moody's stripped the federal government of its AAA bond rating. NPR's Scott Horsley reports it could result in higher borrowing costs for everyone.
Moody's was the last of the big three credit rating agencies to lower its estimate of the U.S. government's credit worthiness. The company warned that U.S. policymakers have failed to address a rising tide of government debt. The move comes as congressional Republicans are weighing an extension of the 2017 tax cut, which is expected to add trillions of dollars in additional red ink over the next decade. That additional borrowing is only partially offset by GOP spending cuts. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks closed mostly higher on Wall Street today. The Dow was up 137 points. The Nasdaq rose 4 points. You're listening to NPR. When President Trump hosts the board of the Kennedy Center at the White House tonight, it's an indication how much time he's apparently devoting to remaking one of the nation's premier cultural institutions. Tonight's meeting of the center's board of trustees follows the firing of the board's previous members and the announcement Trump will serve as chair. A big barrier for those who want to start biking regularly is safety. NPR's Regina Barber reports on a new device that might help make safer cycling routes.
Cycling can be seen by many as a great eco-friendly way of transportation, but it can be dangerous sharing roads with cars. To better understand which routes were safer than others, a team of computer scientists created a sensor to monitor how close cars get to cyclists. Over the span of 2 months in Seattle, Washington, 15 bikes were equipped with the sensor. During that time, the team recorded over 2,000 close passes from cars. These passes were compared to 5 years of bike collisions in the area, and locations of those close passes matched historically dangerous routes. The researchers hope to deploy more sensors in more cities where all of the crowdsourced data can feed into a map that helps anyone find safer bike riding routes. Regina Barber, NPR News.
A vanishing species of whale appears to be giving birth to fewer babies, heightening concerns about the survivability of the animals. Scientists say the endangered right whale continues to see its numbers decline. Currently, it's believed there are only about 370 of the whales left. Right whales give birth to calves off the southeastern U.S. from mid-November to mid-April. While federal authorities say at least 50 whale calves per season are needed, they found only about 11 mother calf pairs this year. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Grand Rapids Riverfest is Saturday, September 6th. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Tickets and info at grandrapidsriverfest.com. Weather tonight, chance of showers, cloudy with lows in the upper 30s. Tomorrow, 50% chance of showers, higher chance in the Brainerd area. Highs 51 to 56 degrees, breezy east winds 15 to 30.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Today, the Supreme Court allowed, for now, the Trump administration to strip legal protections for nearly 350,000 Venezuelans currently living in the U.S. under a program that had protected them from deportation. The court's decision allows the Trump administration to end what is known as temporary protected status, or TPS, for this group, pending an appeal of the case. NPR's Sergio Martinez-Beltran has been following the case and joins us now. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Sergio, tell us what the court ruled today.
Well, that court's ruling was short and unsigned, which is common in emergency orders before the Supreme Court, but it did not elaborate on its reasons for allowing TPS to end for this group of Venezuelans. The court did say that Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson would have denied the application. Now, this is a historic decision. That's what Ahilan Arulan and them told reporters today. He's with the Center for Immigration Law and Policy at UCLA and one of the lawyers representing the Venezuelans.
From what we can tell, this is the single largest action in modern American history, stripping any group of non-citizens of immigration status.
The decision does now pave the way for the possible deportation of tens of thousands of Venezuelans very soon. And we should note, Juana, the Trump administration has also taken steps to end TPS for Haitians, Afghans, and other countries.
So help us understand how we got here. Why was there an emergency request before the court?
Well, as you know, the Trump administration has done a lot on immigration, right? And Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem in February moved to end a Biden-era TPS extension for Venezuelans. Noem basically said that because some Venezuelans in the U.S. have ties to Tren de Aragua, a Venezuelan gang, TPS for every Venezuelan should be terminated. She said continuing TPS for Venezuelans is contrary to the national interest of the United States. As expected, Venezuelans affected by this filed a lawsuit alleging procedural violations and racial bias. A federal judge sided with them and ruled to keep TPS in place. That prompted the Trump administration to file this emergency application to the Supreme Court, and today's ruling puts that lower court decision on hold. Now, some background here, Juana. Venezuelans with TPS are divided into two buckets, those who were granted TPS in 2021 and those who got it when the program was extended in 2023. Today's decision applies to the 2023 cohort.
Got it. Okay. Now, presidents have power to grant TPS to immigrants of a specific country if conditions in their home nation are unsafe. So remind us here what those conditions are.
Yeah, the law says that TPS can be granted if conditions, quote, temporarily prevent the country's nationals from returning safely. The conditions include ongoing armed conflict, civil wars, as well as natural disasters such as earthquakes and epidemics. And this is important because people who have TPS cannot be removed from the U.S. and are allowed to get a work permit as well. They can legally work here.
Well, I mean, political persecution, violence, and other problems have pushed about 8 million Venezuelans to leave their country since 2014. Have things improved there recently?
No, not really. Here's Cecilia Gonzalez. She's one of the Venezuelan plaintiffs.
Returning to Venezuela is not safe at all. The administration have acknowledged the risk of what is going on in Venezuela, but it's still disregarded.
But current DHS Secretary Noem said recently that in the administration's view, things have improved there. That's despite the State Department's continued advisories telling Americans not to travel to Venezuela, citing the high risk of wrongful detention, torture in detention, poor health infrastructure, and other serious challenges.
Sergio, do we have any sense of what is next for these Venezuelans?
Yeah, it's not clear if these people will lose their status immediately or in a week or later. Lawyers say they just don't know. It's now up to the Trump administration to decide how to implement it. The White House has so far not reacted publicly to the ruling. Now, the lawyer said today they will continue to appeal this case in the district court. But again, it's really unclear what happens now and how fast.
NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's turn to the economy now. And to this head scratcher, President Trump has been upending the global economy in the name of bringing back American manufacturing jobs. It's among the reasons he gives to justify his tariffs. But, and here's the head scratcher part, American manufacturers say they are struggling to fill jobs that already exist. Greg Rosalsky from NPR's Planet Money has been reporting on this. Hey there, Greg.
Hey, Mary Louise.
So we are talking like 500,000 unfilled jobs. Why aren't Americans racing to get these jobs?
First, there's pay. This is sort of the classic answer in economics when there's a shortage of something, like you need to raise the price. In this case, that means raising worker wages.
Right.
Now, manufacturers have actually raised their wages in recent years, and that does appear to have dented this problem. If they raise their wages more, that would probably go a long way to dealing with this issue. However, one of the big reasons why a lot of manufacturers left the United States in the first place is because Americans demand higher pay to work these jobs. So this wage issue sort of begs the question whether some manufacturers, particularly labor-intensive ones, can be profitable and globally competitive in the United States.
Okay, so there's the issue of pay and whether these jobs are paying enough to make them interesting to the potential workforce. What are the other two things?
The next issue identified was manufacturing appears to have a PR problem. In the course of my reporting, I learned that, rightly or wrongly, many Americans have this sort of perception of manufacturing that these jobs are often dirty, monotonous, or potentially dangerous. I actually spoke with the head of the Manufacturing Institute. Her name is Carolyn Lee, and she says that these perceptions are really outdated. Manufacturing these days is much different than the manufacturing jobs depicted in Charles Dickens novels. She told me these jobs are clean and bright and full of technology. And she told me that, you know, changing this perception of manufacturing, that could go a long way to dealing with this problem.
Okay, so a PR issue. And then what's number three?
Yeah, so even if the word gets out and young Americans want to do these jobs, they will still need the skills to do them. And that seems like the biggest issue. Now, the first thing I want to say is that manufacturing workers do a lot of different things. And it's not just working on assembly lines. Only around 2 in 5 manufacturing jobs are directly involved in making stuff. Like all other businesses, you know, they have a HR department, a finance department, marketing, and so on. And, you know, that's why around half of these jobs in manufacturing right now require a bachelor's degree. That said, the other half of open manufacturing jobs do not require a bachelor's degree, and manufacturers say they are struggling to fill those. I learned over the course of my reporting that some of the hardest skills to find right now are those aimed at operating and repairing machines and equipment. Manufacturing these days is highly automated, and it's not like anyone could just come off the street and start effectively working with these machines. They need to know things like electrical systems, mechanical systems, hydraulic power, robotics. And everyone I spoke to told me that America needs to do a much better job on vocational training, so more Americans have skills to do modern manufacturing.
Well, and where does that go, the demand for workers with vocational training? I know President Trump just issued an executive order that seems to be anticipating that.
Right. Everyone I spoke to pointed out this issue that America's apprenticeship program just pales in comparison to other advanced industrial nations. According to Third Way, a centrist think tank, in 2022, only 0.3% of the American working age population was in apprenticeship programs. For comparison, in Switzerland, that figure was 3.6%, or 12 times higher. I think what is clear is that bringing American manufacturing back will likely require more than just slapping up tariffs or investing lots of money to build new factories. Leaders may need to regear our education system. They might need to regear high schools and community colleges, and they may need to invest a lot more in apprenticeship programs to build the workforce that American manufacturers need.
That is Greg Rosalsky of NPR's Planet Money. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
Cleanup is underway after deadly storms swept through Missouri and Kentucky Friday night. Karen Czar with member station WUKY reports from the small town of London in southern Kentucky, where one massive tornado left a path of death and destruction. The shaken congregation of First Baptist Church of London cried together during Sunday service. They prayed for church members who lost everything. Pastor Jesse Armstrong told them their faith and community would get them through. He says relief came quickly.
There were so many people that came up here to help, and I didn't call a single one of them.
Supplies started showing up at the church just hours after the disaster, and volunteers came from the town, other parts of the state, and from across the country to help. Deshaun Henderson and Timmy Mills drove up from Whitley County, about 30 minutes away.
We're helping load this truck, and then we're going to load our car and go out and deliver some things.
We're willing to put our hands in and help wherever we're needed.
In less than an hour, a caravan headed to Sunshine Hills, the hardest hit neighborhood. Hundreds of people had already arrived with chainsaws, bobcats, tractors, and other heavy equipment to move rubble. Amanda Radford dug through piles by hand, trying to find any mementos of her parents.
Their house was, as you can see, there was nothing standing. Their SUV was here in their garage, and it landed on their bedroom. They were in the bed.
They both died. The house is completely gone. A piece of chain link fence wrapped around a tree. Their lawnmower was found in a neighbor's yard.
Very little left, and very little salvageable.
A few streets over, the supplies from the church are unloaded into Sherry Shepherd's garage.
We're getting into nothing but the big ones now.
Her home was miraculously spared. But when you walk into her backyard, you can see a path of destruction with trees snapped in half and neighbors' homes broken apart or completely gone.
Kind of feel guilty that we have, but I mean, we're just trying to help as much as we can.
State officials are still assessing the overall damage from the tornadoes, but they say it is massive. For NPR News, I'm Karen Czar in London, Kentucky.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your daily dose of phonology. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Blast Wi-Fi, featuring Wi-Fi 6 technology to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications. It's right here. Now it's time for your daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, May 19th, 2001, common lilacs burst forth in bloom, and the common lilacs are typically blooming just about now. I think the average date for the first flower on the common lilacs in Grand Rapids is the 20th of May. But what's really amazing about lilacs is that they are genetically identical, for the most part, across the country. And they were planted by the early settlers as a phenological tool. When the common lilac bloomed, the farmers knew that the soil temperatures were at the right point for germination of corn. And so they would plant their corn when they saw the lilacs in bloom. And that's not the only example of plants being valued for their phenological information, but it is one of the most common plants that you can find across the country. And it is the subject of some pretty intensive phenological research even now, because it has a very specific genealogy, and that creates a nice, even measure as spring moves north across the nation. And so lilacs have become very, very important as a measure of climate change.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The new book, Original Sin, President Biden's Decline, Its Cover-Up, and His Disastrous Choice to Run Again. It recounts the story of a president who struggled to remember the names of close advisors, who lacked physical stamina, who was insulated from aides and fellow Democrats for years. The book is out this week, the same week that Biden told the world he has been diagnosed with stage 4 prostate cancer. That diagnosis underscores a question at the heart of the reporting in Original Sin. Was Biden too old and too frail to run? Another question the book explores, did some of Biden's closest aides, aides like Steve Ricchetti and Mike Donilon, cover up his decline? That is something our co-host Scott Detrow discussed with Original Sin authors Jake Tapper of CNN and Alex Thompson of Axios.
Alex, what to you was the moment that most alarmed you as a person who lives in the United States as you were reporting and learning these details about the things that were happening behind the scene?
I was interviewing a longtime Biden aide, and they're quoted in the book as saying, I'm paraphrasing here, all he had to do was win, then he could have disappeared for the next 4 years and only had to occasionally show proof of life. When you're electing a president, I think voters know that they're also electing the people around them. And that was
this was their justification.
This was their justification for, they basically were acknowledging, yeah, he's like having trouble, but like the threat of Donald Trump, which I think they felt very sincere about, was so great that they were justifying in some ways undemocratic actions.
Yeah, and these are the same people who say, hey, nobody elected Elon Musk. Well, no one elected Donilon and Ricchetti, and yet we have a cabinet secretary telling us that Biden, Ricchetti, and Donilon would make decisions about the economy without even talking to Secretary Yellen during the period that they cut off the cabinet.
You talked to a lot of anonymous sources for this book. Did anybody regret not speaking out? Or was it, this is the reality I saw, but it was career suicide to say that he couldn't run for another term, so in retrospect, I wouldn't say anything?
If not regret, a lot of soul searching about what could I have done differently. You know, one person sort of put to me this way, it was like how many options were there? Like, they could have gone public, but would that have changed Joe Biden's mind? Probably not. And then it would have just helped Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Now, the one thing that I think people are mad about that the inner circle especially didn't do, the ones that knew better, is you don't necessarily have to go public, but why not confront him?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard someone give a good answer.
And who confronted him? Secretary of State Blinken kind of confronted him?
He had the meeting with, he had a lunch with him in 2023 in which he basically was like, you know, you have to think about how old you're going to be in the second term. You know, do you think you can handle it? Of course, Biden does. And that's kind of just dropped. You know, I think everybody in that circle, in that world should be thinking, I'm certainly thinking as a journalist, what should I have done differently? You know, Alex and I cover this, Alex very aggressively from the White House beat, me less so, and I wish I had been more aggressive. There's a lot of regret. There's a lot of humility.
I want to end this interview the way you start the book, that the morning after the election, Joe Biden woke up convinced he could have won.
He still thinks that. He still thinks he could have won. He went on The View to pre-butt this book, we think, and he was asked about that, and he said, well, look, I still got 7 million more votes than Donald Trump. Now, he's talking about the 2020 election. And the truth of the matter is, I have talked to his pollsters more than he ever has, and they did not think that. And Chuck Schumer, when Chuck Schumer finally has the conversation with Biden, in which he says that he thinks Biden should drop out, he says, I've talked to your pollsters. They give you a 5% chance of winning. And Biden did not know that because all the polling was interpreted through the spinmeisters around him, Donilon and Ricchetti. And Biden's shocked to hear that. When I talked with one of the pollsters about that story, 5%, he said it was probably more like 1%.
That's Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson. Their new book is Original Sin, President Biden's Decline, Its Cover-Up, and His Disastrous Choice to Run Again. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks.
In response to Original Sin, a Biden spokesperson told NPR that they, quote, have not reviewed the book and the authors did not fact-check the book with us, despite that being a common practice to do so.
President Biden's diagnosis with metastatic prostate cancer highlights some of the progress made in treatments of the disease, as well as some of its challenges. NPR's consumer health correspondent Yuki Noguchi joins us to discuss what it all means. Hi there.
Hi.
Yuki, many of us have often heard that prostate cancer is common. What are the risks of getting it and then surviving?
You know, it's the most common form of cancer in men. Only lung cancer is more lethal. But there are huge recent developments in drugs and detection, so survival is rapidly increasing. Oncologist William Dayhood is chief scientific officer of the American Cancer Society. Before that, he researched prostate cancer for 2 decades.
Prostate cancer mortality has fallen by about 50% since the early 90s, which is a spectacular number.
I mean, it's a lot. And he says much of that is because of earlier detection, as well as new treatments that have made, you know, even faster growing aggressive disease like former President Biden's easier to fight.
Now, what we've seen in terms of the statement about Biden's diagnosis mentions that his cancer appears hormone sensitive, and that's good for prognosis. Can you explain why?
Yeah, earlier I mentioned big advances in cancer treatments, and one of the big ones is the breakthrough in understanding the significant roles hormones play in feeding cancer. Hormones fuel gynecologic cancers like breast or ovarian cancer, too. And it turns out cancer growth can also be interrupted by starving it, or testosterone or estrogen. Now, this ability in general to be able to target cancer is very, very key to understanding why cancer is more survivable today. You know, being able to identify and kill only the cancer cells and not the healthy ones reduces those nasty side effects that can make, you know, it very hard for patients. Here's Dr. Dayhood again.
Men who have a very long response to multiple hormonal therapies are the ones who, you know, have the sort of the best overall quality of life and tend to live the longest with metastatic prostate cancer.
Now, Yuki, we've been told that this was caught after it had metastasized to his bones, and presumably presidents, they get more medical attention than the rest of us. So how might this have gone undetected until it had spread?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, one of the things that's true generally about the population is that only about a third of men are screened for prostate cancer, you know, which starts out with a blood test and then an MRI if you need it and a biopsy. Access to care for those things can be an issue for the overall public, especially in minority communities. Obviously, that is not the case for, you know, former President Joe Biden. His cancer is also unusual in that it is aggressive and fast growing, which, you know, typically prostate cancer is not, you know. But another reason why it might not have been caught is that, you know, the guideline gurus and, you know, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, you know, no longer recommends routine screening for men over the age of 70. And that's because most tumors are slow growing. So right. There aren't a lot of benefits to treatment at a certain age. Doctors often recommend watchful waiting. But obviously, in this case, okay, with the president, that's not going to work.
NPR's Yuki Noguchi, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
How is anxiety about U.S. government debt affecting the financial markets? We'll pursue that question and also hear a skeptical take on OpenAI.
It was founded as a research nonprofit for, as it said, the benefit of all of humanity.
How did OpenAI change? Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It is 429, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Coming up next is National Native News. Support comes from Beltrami County Historical Society in Bemidji, offering 6 days of real talk about periods during Menstruation Health Week, May 26th through May 31st, with a special museum exhibit, documentary screenings, author talks, and a community period product drive. Details at beltramihistory.org/period. Kick it with KXE on Thursday, May 22nd. You're invited to kick off patio season with a free outdoor concert featuring Molly Mayer and Woodblind Meets Teague Alexi featuring TNT Hi-Fi at Rapids Brewing Company. We start at 5:30 with KXE's annual meeting, including a brief recap of the past year and nomination and introduction of new potential board members. Interested in joining the board? Email Sarah at KAXE.org. Made possible with support from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana's Native families face higher rates of separation, with a disproportionate number of Native kids in foster care. A nonprofit in Lodge Grass is developing a center aimed at keeping tribal families together and out of social services. Montana Public Radio's Victoria Traxler has more.
Mountain Shadow Association recently began construction of a family healing center to support communities on the Crow Reservation. Executive Director Megan Doyle explains addiction and behavioral health issues can break apart families. She says children from the reservation are often sent to foster care families out of state when these issues arise. The center, called Kala's Village, aims to change that.
That's what Kala's Village is really trying to do, is provide this consistent and constant relationship and connection, and to help repair those places where connection and relationship are broken.
The center's approach is based in restorative justice, which aims to address the root cause of crimes instead of incarceration. Doyle says they hope to break cycles of abuse and trauma. Kala's Village was developed from years of direct dialogue between the nonprofit and Lodge Grass community members.
They really wanted it to be a safe place for them and for their children. And they also wanted to make sure that they were going to be surrounded by people who shared similar goals with them in recovery. So
the 13-acre campus will have housing along with a preschool and caretakers to help supervise the children. Doyle says they hope to fully open by the end of 2026. In Missoula, I'm Victoria Traxler.
Extreme heat can affect the health of pregnant mothers. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez reports, a new study shows the warming climate is adding to that risk, and several states in the Mountain West region are leading the way.
One of the most significant findings from the Climate Central study is that excessive exposure to heat can lead to premature births. The Policy Neutral Organization's Vice President of Science, Christina Dahl, says heat incidents can have lasting effects on the baby and the mother. It's exacerbated by their socioeconomic vulnerability. Air conditioning in areas that are experiencing hotter summers is important.
So people who have less access to cooling have, you know, less of an infrastructure around preventative health care, tend to be more at risk when it comes to extreme heat exposure.
Lower income women are disproportionately affected. In our region, Utah experienced the most additional pregnancy heat risk days during the past 5 years. Overall, the study shows Nevada, Utah, Arizona, Colorado, and New Mexico experienced among the highest number of pregnancy heat risk days in the country. I'm Yvette Fernandez.
Navajo Highways, a new children's television series, is helping teach kids the Navajo language. The live-action puppet series follows the summer adventures of Sadie, a young girl from an urban background who spends time with her Navajo grandmother. Through the guidance of her family and community, she explores Navajo traditions, language, and values. Lori Tapahanso is a co-producer of the show.
It is a accompaniment to any kind of immersion program, but also a standalone language program that teaches children about culture and in a language in a fun and engaging way. It encourages families to learn together, but also children can learn on their own.
This series is written and directed by Pete Sands with support from the Navajo Nation and the New Mexico Public Education Department. The series will soon be featured on First Nations Experience's new streaming platform. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
We'll be right back.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by...
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at WTGrantFDN.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. A massive search is still underway in New Orleans for 7 of the 10 inmates who escaped from the city's largest jail. Of the 10 men who escaped in the early hours of Friday morning, 3 have been apprehended. Authorities are now investigating the incident as a possible inside job. Matt Bloom with member station WWNO has been following the latest. Hi, Matt.
Hey there.
Matt, just start by telling us, what does the response look like now?
Well, we've got a major law enforcement presence here. The FBI, U.S. Marshals, and state police got involved over the weekend. They've got drones and helicopters in the air. They've used facial recognition cameras to find and arrest 3 of the escapees already, as you mentioned. And last night, the FBI and other agencies increased the reward for information to $20,000 for each of the remaining 7 that are still out. We're all being told that they're armed and dangerous, and we're getting text alerts each time they capture another inmate. So as you can imagine, this is the talk of the town. People are going on with their lives. There's festivals. It's graduation season, like Tulane University just had theirs. So life is still going on.
What can you tell us, if anything, about the inmates who escaped and also about how they escaped?
Well, they're all men ranging in age from 19 to 42. They were in jail awaiting trial on a variety of charges, including aggravated assault, domestic abuse, battery, and murder. As far as how these 10 men got out, video shows them break open a cell door and remove a toilet from the wall. They then fit through a hole behind that toilet, climb over some fencing, and run across an interstate. Now, there's still a lot of unanswered questions about how they were able to do all of that. They even had time to stop and write a note over the hole in the wall saying, quote, too easy. Our sheriff, Susan Hudson, says that they likely had help.
We have indication that these detainees received assistance in their escape from individuals inside of our department. And the escape was discovered during a routine headcount at 8:30 a.m.
She's now investigating at least 3 of her own deputies for potential involvement. And as one deputy noted in a press conference, you would need power tools to loosen the toilet from a cell wall.
Now, I understand that this prison was understaffed. What are officials saying about that?
Absolutely. Sheriff Hudson says staffing is around 60% of what it should be, so super low. It took her staff over 8 hours to discover the jailbreak and notify the public. But she says it's not new that they're underfunded.
I have been actively advocating since I got into office for more money to fix these broken parts of the jail that make it unsecure.
As you can imagine, she's now getting a lot of the blame, though, for moving too slow on some of these improvements she's talking about, even though we do have plans for a new jail here.
And this is not the first time New Orleans has had inmates escape, is that right?
Correct. We've had some smaller escapes back in 2009 and 2020, but nothing this large in recent history. Our district attorney says he's concerned about the safety of himself and prosecutors. At the state level, our Republican legislature's already introduced a bill that would require faster notification to the public of inmate escapes. And our Republican governor, Jeff Landry, says he's ordered a full audit of the Orleans Parish Jail.
The public deserves to know who, what, and how this happened.
He's also using this as another opportunity to criticize the Democratic leadership in New Orleans as being too soft on crime. Since taking office, he's increased state police presence in New Orleans, especially if you remember since the truck attack on Bourbon Street on New Year's Day.
Yep.
And he says after this latest breach that more state interference is needed.
Matt Bloom with member station WWNO in New Orleans. Thanks.
Thank you.
After a post-pandemic crisis, military recruiters are on a winning streak again. WUNC's Jay Price looks at what's behind the turnaround.
Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth says it's simple.
We've already seen a huge surge under President Trump of Americans who want to join.
President Trump agrees.
It's all happened since November 5th.
But neither the Pentagon nor the Army responded to requests for information to back up claims that Trump is the reason. Catherine Kuzminski studies recruiting at the bipartisan Center for New American Security.
We don't know. There is no data that says, you know, did the outcome of the election spur you to join the military?
What we do know is that the numbers are up, and despite what the president says, that increase began well before the election. Beth Ash at the RAND Corporation has been analyzing military manpower issues for four decades. She says in 2022, the Army missed its recruiting goal by about 25%, or 15,000 soldiers. The following year, it, the Navy, and the Air Force all fell short.
It was spreading, if you will. So the people were calling this a recruiting crisis.
But by the end of fiscal 2024, on September 30th, the services all met their recruiting missions. And in the most recent numbers released in February,
the services have all been either meeting or even exceeding their mission. So that's a good news story and is certainly a turnaround.
Indeed, Hegseth said Army recruiting is going better than it has in more than a decade. But the foundation of this success was built well before Trump's election. Again, analyst Catherine Kuzminski.
We have seen the services really made an effort to modernize structures and processes to the recruiting enterprise. We saw, especially in the Army, a real professionalization of the way that we approach managing recruiters themselves.
The military also boosted spending on advertising and marketing. And perhaps most importantly, the Army in 2022 created the Future Soldier Preparatory Course, which tutors potential enlistees to improve their test scores and helps those who don't meet the weight standards trim down. Last year, the Army got nearly one quarter of its recruits through that program, and Kuzminski says it's cost effective.
It's actually much more expensive in marketing and outreach to change someone's mind about whether or not they want to serve in the military than it might be to help individuals who don't currently meet the standard come up to the standard.
One thing that stands out about the Army's recruitment growth is that it's disproportionately driven by women. In the 2024 recruiting year, about 10,000 women enlisted, an 18% increase from the year before.
Whereas for male recruitment, we saw only an 8% increase.
Kuzminski says there's no way to know yet how the new administration might affect that trend. Just as there's no data to show how many recruits may have enlisted because of Trump, we also don't know how many people have been turned off by things like Hegseth's opposition to DEI and women in combat roles.
We don't have a survey among individuals who didn't join, why they didn't join, and whether or not the election outcome had something to do with that.
Also, Ash cautions that some of the services have accepted more recruits with lower aptitude test scores and more without high school diplomas.
Not all the services are on track right now to be meeting those quality marks. And those quality marks matter because they're related to readiness.
Trump, meanwhile, has entirely banned one group, transgender people, in a move that's still playing out in the courts. The military has already begun pushing some out. If the ban is upheld, it would bar several thousand existing troops from serving and others from signing up. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Durham, North Carolina.
You're listening to All Things Considered. International humanitarian groups are still reeling from President Trump slashing hundreds of jobs and spending by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. There are consequences, large and small, reaching all the way down to high school science fairs. Henry Larson has this report from Colorado.
In February, 15-year-old Max Kurtz was setting up for his first ever high school science fair in Boulder, Colorado.
I don't know. I was just looking at people's projects, but I think the biggest thing I saw was that I was underdressed. So I texted my parents and I was like, hey, can you bring me some clothes? I think I'm underdressed for this. And I don't think my dad was very happy about it, but he did pull through.
Kurtz had been working with a mentor at the University of Colorado on a project that measured microbes in soil, which could help farmers get the most yield from their crops. He didn't advance to the next round of competition, but his project did win an award sponsored by the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. The award was given to projects that hold, quote, the potential to improve lives around the world. And it came with a prize, a conversation with a USAID employee to talk about his project and about pursuing a career in science and engineering with a humanitarian focus. That was a big deal for Max.
USAID does so much for developing communities, which is something that's really important to me, right? Something that I want to do in the long term career-wise.
But then, a few days later, he got an email from the Society for Science, which helps coordinate science fairs all over the country. It said USAID pulled all their contracts with science fairs. And that conversation Max was promised, it was canceled. Society for Science's Hunter Hart.
Essentially, the point of that message was just to say, hey, we've received this staff work order. You know, obviously, this agency is no longer functioning and is being dissolved.
USAID has sponsored awards at these competitions for more than a decade, including a cash prize for an international science fair, giving away more than $300,000 over the last decade. Not anymore. Max Kurtz's prize didn't come with money, just a conversation with a USAID staffer. But Hart says it's still unfortunate.
And maybe it made them feel like their work wasn't as valued as it once was, right? To receive something and then be told, oh, by the way, the organization that you received this award from can't honor it because of larger issues.
Hunter estimates that about a third of the Society for Science's affiliated regional fairs in the United States happened before he received that stop work order. A statement from a State Department spokesperson said supporting science fair awards did, quote, not fit within the standards laid out by Secretary Rubio for U.S. foreign assistance, which must make the United States stronger, safer, or more prosperous. Cuts to USAID are having much bigger effects around the world than the loss of science fair prizes for U.S. high schoolers. Billions of dollars that were destined to fight infectious diseases and hunger aren't getting spent. For Max Kurtz, the Colorado sophomore, his science fair project has been a hard lesson.
After having the award taken away, even though it's not nearly as big of a deal or anywhere close to as big of a deal as losing your job or getting aid to your country cut, it's still just made the funding cuts that are happening in other areas feel so much more real on a personal level.
Kurtz is still interested in science. He's already planning to enter the fair again next year, and he's working on a new design to make that soil sensor he helped build even better. For NPR News, I'm Henry Larson.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team. KAXE has a mission to build community throughout northern Minnesota. Our loyal audience supports the community organizations that support KAXE. Consider joining us in building community in northern Minnesota. Learn more, email sponsor at kaxe.org. Thank you. The Minnesota DNR reminds boaters to stay safe while enjoying the water this season. Wear your life jacket and make sure children are wearing theirs. Stay sober, let others know where you are going, and be aware of the weather. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Northland Arboretum in Brainerd has bird hikes Wednesday and Saturday mornings during the month of May at 8 a.m. Binoculars provided, or you may bring your own. The 11th Loop the Lake Festival is Saturday, June 21st. Volunteers are needed to work 2 to 3 hour shifts. No special skills required. Organizers hope to have all shifts filled by the end of May. Contact KAXE for more information. Call or text 218-326-1234. There are free day camps in June for girls ages 14 through 17 who are interested in learning trades like carpentry, welding, and electric with hands-on learning and local industry tours. Camps are located in Grand Rapids, Hibbing, and Virginia. For full details, visit minnesotanorth.edu/events. The Itasca Youth Orchestra performs Wednesday, May 21st at 5:30 at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids. Tickets at itascaorchestra.org. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Since Syria's new government took over late last year, Israel has hit more than 300 targets inside its neighbor's territory. Recent weeks have seen strikes in and around the Syrian capital. Israel says the strikes are to protect a religious minority that is under attack from Islamist armed factions loyal to the new Syrian government. Violent clashes this month have killed about 100 Druze. That's according to rights groups. The small Druze community straddles the border between Israel and Syria. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports from northern Israel.
Israeli soldiers stand in front of the barbed wire fence separating this hill in the Druze town of Mejd el-Shems in the occupied Golan Heights. Resident Salha Abu Saleh peers through binoculars into Syria, just on the other side of the tall barrier. She waves to her daughter, Hasna, who's sheltering in a small home there with her family. They fled the recent violence in their village near Damascus. Her 67-year-old mother, Abu Saleh, says they have little there. Yesterday they asked for water, Abu Saleh says the water tank is dry. Abu Saleh is part of the Druze community living on the Israeli side of the border. It's a close-knit religious minority, an offshoot of Shia Islam. Many have family in Syria. They're worried about them as sectarian clashes broke out in Druze villages there. Some Druze see the new rulers of Syria as hardline Islamists, and some of the armed factions in Syria's new government see the Druze as heretics. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has also become involved. We are committed to our brothers, to our sisters, to the Druze community, he says. Not just in Israel, Netanyahu says, but also in Syria. He's backed that up with strikes near the Syrian presidential palace this month, calling it a warning, and that more will come if violence against the Druze continues. Israel sent aid to Syrian Druze villages affected by the violence and evacuated some of the injured for treatment to an Israeli hospital. Some Druze in Israel applaud the support. Many have Israeli citizenship and serve in the Israeli army. Amir Khnefes heads the Israeli Druze Center.
We believe that we should have the same support for our people and for our community, whether in Israel or across the border.
Some have been demonstrating, blocking roads and burning tires. A group of Israeli Druze soldiers are pushing for more military action. But not all are on board. Saeed Nafa is a former Druze member of the Israeli parliament. He worries his community is being used to further Netanyahu's ambitions in the Middle East. To tear up Syria, to divide it for Israel's long-term political strategy, etc., he says. Netanyahu says that strategy is to keep Israel safe after the fall of the Assad regime. It even seized a buffer zone in Syrian territory that the UN has patrolled for decades. And for months, Israeli forces have been expanding further into Syrian villages. Shira Efron of the Israel Policy Forum says Israel's actions could endanger the Syrian Druze, making them look like collaborators, Israel's proxies.
Which doesn't help them, actually makes them even more vulnerable to anti-Druze biases.
And she says it's not the wisest move for Israel to be injecting itself into the political instability in Syria today.
Israel is really not on top of the list of their concerns now in Syria. The country is just trying to rebuild itself, and you're turning Israel into a problem.
All this uncertainty between Syria and Israel weighs heavily on the divided Abu Saleh family on the hill in Mejd el-Shems in the occupied Golan Heights. Salha Abu Saleh calls her daughter Hasna just within eyesight over the fence. Hasna tells her mom she's scared. There's no safety or stability, and that's what she's really looking for. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News. Mejd el-Shems in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from John Hegwood. When Hegwood was 16, he found out he was going to be a father. By the following year, in 2008, he was working two jobs and attending school while also caring for his baby. It was too much. He had enough credits to apply for a GED, so he decided to pursue that path and drop out of school. That spring, Hegwood made an appointment with his principal, Billy Barnett, to share his decision.
So I show up in his office, which is just like a little closet, effectively, and Mr. Barnett called me in, and it's just a single desk with a chair, sits me down, and I told him that I was ready to drop out of high school because I had two jobs and a baby at home and, you know, I was living in the real world and I needed to provide for my family and I didn't have time for high school anymore. And he's imploring me to continue with high school and that he wasn't going to let me drop out. And I told him that it was my choice. And he looked me in the eyes and was like, "It may seem that way and I understand that you have a lot going on, but it's very important that you finish high school and that you get this diploma because it's going to shape the rest of your life." So he bargained with me to stay into school and he was able to cut some of my classes and kind of make it fit for my schedule. And I kept my end of the deal. I was able to walk the stage for high school graduation. And, you know, I still have that picture sitting on our desk of myself with my son, who's a baby in that picture. He's now 17, you know, at my graduation with me wearing my high school robes. I didn't even realize until last year, probably, how much of an impact that single decision really shaped my life, what it is now. I was able to join the military, and so that put me on the career path that I'm at now, which is in IT and information security. And my work is still relating to both the military and to the IT field. I'm a pretty accomplished professional. I've owned two homes, and all of that is because of his insistence that I finish high school. I made it a point to try and look him up, and I had realized that he has unfortunately passed on. But I hope that wherever he is, he knows that he's made an impact on my life specifically, and I'm sure many other students, because I was just one of hundreds that have been around him. And so I'm really grateful.
John Hegwood lives in Lacey, Washington. His son Ryan just graduated from high school. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at hiddenbrain.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Mathnasium. Whether students are ahead of the curve or need extra support, Mathnasium's goal is to build confidence through personalized math instruction. Learn more at mathnasium.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, sailing the transatlantic crossing between New York and Southampton, England on Queen Mary II. Dedicated to providing White Star service, fine dining, and enrichment programs. Learn more at cunard.com. From Linda Moodbell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead. Online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodbell.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Beltrami Electric Cooperative, your Touchstone Energy Cooperative, providing energy to keep lights on, coffee hot, and batteries charged. connecting communities, empowering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years. More at BeltramiaElectric.com. The Forest History Center in Grand Rapids has Warbler Walks every Wednesday and Saturday in May at 7 a.m. Meet at the parking lot. Weather tonight, chance of showers, cloudy with lows in the upper 30s. Tomorrow, 50% chance of showers, higher chance in the Brainerd area, highs 51 to 56. Breezy.